dealing with all these different weeks we've had to not have class. And thank you for your grace in allowing Pastor Joe to fill in for me for a week when I was in Mexico. I want to start out with prayer. We've got handouts coming around, and we'll jump in here to Genesis. And my intent is to finish Genesis by next week. So we got a ways to go and very little time to do it. So let's go ahead and pray. Father, we come to you this morning humbled. We come grateful. We come recognizing that you are holy. Today we come content because of Christ and all that he has accomplished for us. We thank you for his faithfulness. We thank you for the glory that we see in throughout the scriptures. And even as we think about the life of Abraham today, Lord, I pray for your mercy and grace to help us by your Spirit to understand your truth and to be able to see the glory of Christ in these pages. Because, Lord, this is not a mere book that we're studying. This is the very God-breathed scriptures. And we thank you for giving them to us as a gift so that we don't have to guess at what your will is or who you are, but we have it in black and white. And we thank you for these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, so quick review. Once again, just to kind of get us back on track here, my intent for this course, again, is not to go into every detail of every book. We just don't have the time to do that for this course. But we're doing a flyover of the law. And if you remember from the very beginning, what we set out to do was to sort of, if you think about the idea of ziplining from platform to platform, I want to be able to help. Well, I want us to be able to sort of hook ourselves to a line, a plot line. And if we think of the different books of the law sort of as the platforms, that's what we want to be able to do, to sort of hook ourselves to this plot line that God has unfolding. Now, 2 weeks ago, I think it was, Pastor Joe taught on Genesis 1 through 11. And who was here for that lesson, by the way? Okay, for those of you who were here, what did you learn? What would you say? This is the line that we can hook ourselves to throughout the book of the law. Was there anything that you would say, this is something that we could hook to help us to be able to, well, when we get to perhaps parts of Exodus, not grow bored and close the book and forget that we ever read any of it? What would be something that you say, we can hook ourselves onto this? Okay, the seed promise, right? Genesis 3:15, and Pastor Joe took that promise and followed it, chapter 3, all the way through chapter 11, and we finished up hopefully somewhere around the Table of Nations and the generations of Shem, right? So as we go throughout the book of Genesis, but even into the rest of the law, this seed promise is going to be that major hook line for us. There are some other things, too, that are sort of, maybe if you think about that cable and we've got, you know, multiple cables wound together, that's the primary one. But we're going to find a few other ones. And as you think about that seed promise, what's going to need to happen as we follow that? Well, we have this sort of magic phrase in Genesis, right? Who remembers what the magic phrase is that gives us the structure of the book of Genesis? These are, yes, these are the generations of. That's the structure of Genesis. Every time you find that phrase, every time you encounter that phrase, we're going to see, okay, here's the next step in following that seed promise. So as we're following it, what we're going to begin to do in the book of Genesis is see that it goes sort of from like this broad view, there's this seed that's coming out of the woman. We don't know a whole lot about it, but we're going to see that it sort of begins to focus in step by step on a specific line. We saw that in the story of Noah and the flood. Everything, all human life, except for Noah and his family, are completely wiped off the face of the earth through the flood, right? Now we have these generations going out, or these different nations going out, and so we're not quite sure where the seed promise is going to go from here, but at this point, we're going to begin to focus down on a particular family. So open up to Genesis chapter 11, if you would. And I want to begin by reading, somebody please read verses 27 to 32. And I want you to sort of like think about what we just said. Broad, down into a specific focus. Where is this seed promise going to come? All right. So could someone read verses 27, Genesis 11, verses 27 to 32.
Now these are the records of the generations of Terah. Terah became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran became the father of Lot. Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his birth in Ur of the Chaldeans. Abram and Nahor took wives for themselves. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Iscah. Sarai was barren, and she had no children. Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went out together from Ur of the Chaldeans in order to enter the land of Canaan. And they went as far as Haran and settled there. The days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran.
Okay, so we start out with this section of Genesis with that really magic phrase, right? These are the generations of who?
Terah.
Okay, so this is important. Whenever you see that phrase, we need to pay attention, all right? So we're paying attention. Terah. So he has three sons, right? Abram, Nahor, Haran. Now, notice what happens. You got three sons, Terah, right? What happens in this text? Do we have all three continuing through the text? No, what happens? One dies. All right, you got two left, and Terah. They head out, right? Haran died. Abram and Nahor took wives for themselves. Who are their wives, by the way? Abram's is Sarai. We know that, right? But interestingly enough, look in verse 30. Why does it tell us this detail? Okay, so we're following the seed promise, right? We're trying to figure out where's this going to go? Where are we going to track this? Well, we have these three sons and the father. Now we're down to two. And they both have wives. And the one wife, who happens to be the wife of Abram, is barren and she has no children. Okay, well, probably isn't going to be through her then, huh? Okay. Verse 31, and Terah took Abram his son and Lot the son of Haran. Okay, so we're now down to how many sons going? One son and a grandson, okay? So, interesting that we get here and we see that at least Abram has a wife, yet it's the one that can't bear any children. So, in our minds, we might be thinking, oh, this isn't it. But yet, it follows Abram, the one with this wife who's barren. And Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson. And Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son, Abram's wife. And they went out together from Ur of the Chaldeans in order to go to, interesting, the land of Canaan. Now, if you're remember the original audience of this book. If you're an Israelite who's just come out of the Exodus and you're being told we're going to be going to this land, which happens to be Canaan, okay? How's this going to speak to you? What's this going to be saying to you? oh, he's giving us some information about where we're going here. Like, we're on our way there. Okay? So they're on their way to Canaan. They came as far as Haran and settled there. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. So we don't even have dad anymore. We have Abram and the grandson of Terah, Lot, right? So what's going to happen with this seed promise? That's the question we should be asking at this point. As we get into this section, this next section of Genesis, and really the book of Genesis is kind of divided into two, chapters 1 to 11, and then here in chapter 12, all the way through the end in chapter 50, we have in this section, the Creator's promise and his people. And this section can be divided in a lot of different ways, but the main plot tracks that seed promise through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Jacob's sons. It also highlights two of Jacob's sons. So as we follow this and track this, we're going to see today, we're going to focus in on Abram and his life, but we're eventually going to see it focus in on two of Jacob's sons. Who are they? Well, number one, we have Joseph. And, you know, again, I just want to remind us that, like, this isn't just character studies, like flannel graph on Sunday, you know, Sunday school, okay? These stories are in there for more than just character studies. So we have Joseph and we have Judah. Joseph is going to be highlighted as the righteous one of Jacob's sons who stays consistently faithful to God. Joseph becomes sort of the mechanism through which God preserves his promised offspring and saves them out of, saves the lives of his brothers in Egypt. Okay, so kind of keep that in the back of your mind as we go through here. And as for the second son that is focused on, that's Judah. And Judah is not exactly the most righteous one of his brothers. In fact, not at all. But his offspring are Jacob's blessing. His offspring and his line receives blessing from his father Jacob. And they're highlighted throughout particularly in chapter 38 and through Jacob's blessing upon his descendants. Judah was to be known for victory over enemies, and as one from whom rulers, or particularly a ruler, was going to come. One descendant of Judah was going to come and rule all people. So as we enter into this, what we need to keep in mind is what we're tracking, what we're hooking our line onto, is that seed promise. And some of these important things, like Canaan that we just noticed, focusing in on a particular line. And we'll also see this theme of blessing, too. So here we have a new section, just began in chapter 11, verse 27, the generations of Terah. This is going to run from chapter 11, verse 27, all the way through chapter 25 and verse 11. So this section contains this narrative of Abraham. Chapter 12 is particularly important, because it is where God makes his first promise to Abram. So let's go ahead and have somebody read in chapter 12, and we'll go verses 1. We'll go 1 through 3 for now. Just jump in. So, here we have this promise that God makes to Abram. What do you see in these verses? What does God promise Abram in these verses? Okay, great nation. That is talking about seed, right? Descendants. I'm going to make you a great nation. Good. What else? Bless you. It's going to be, what would that look like, do you think? I'm going to bless you. Provision. Good. Okay. What else do we see?
Land.
Okay. Where do you see that? Okay, land that I will show you. What land do you think this could be? We had foreshadowing, didn't we? All the way back in the end of chapter 11, we have this, well, all he knows is the land I'm going to show you, right? Interestingly enough, they've already set out in that direction, right? To go to the land of the Chaldeans, or to, the land of Canaan, from the land of the Chaldeans. God's promise to Abraham consists of three things. And again, this is sort of one of those things that we need to hook ourselves onto here. Land, seed, and what? Blessing. Three things, right? A land, a specific land. Seed, descendants, a nation, and blessing. Now, does this make you in any way think about Genesis 3:15? It should, right? Because that's the main theme that we're following here. Abram responds to all this by doing what? Let's look in verses 4 through 9. Can someone read those for us? How does Abram respond? Yeah. Right, that would be part of the promise of the blessing. So I'm kind of including it in that. Yeah, it's a good observation. So yeah, it'll be a blessing to those who bless you, cursing to those who curse you. And we're going to see that happen. This is all foreshadowing. We're going to see this happen and unfold. But can somebody read verses 4 through 9 for us? Okay, so Abram responds here to all this by building an altar, calling on the name of Yahweh, right? He's got these promises to him, and so as we read the book of Genesis, what we want to be looking for is how this is all going to play out. By the way, thank you, Neil, for stopping me. If you're kind of questioning anything or you're wondering anything, you see something that you're wondering about, just stop me. There's like a lot of material here in very little time. So just, let's stop. So that's what we should expect to be following, is the playing out of these things. In the second half of chapter 12, we see God's protection of Abram and Sarai in Egypt. Now again, as we're reading all these things, you got to be thinking in terms of like what would have been like for the original audience, the people of Israel who had just been brought out of Egypt to go toward this promised land. What would all of this mean to them? I mean, just think about the towns that are named. Bethel, Ai. What happened to Ai? Did they have anything happen to them? Yeah, they sure did. That's setting up Joshua, isn't it? I mean, this is a phenomenal work of the Holy Spirit here, foreshadowing all of these things that are going to take place, naming even these towns that are going to be super important to the to tracking the faithfulness of God to keep His promises. Well, in chapter 12, verses 10 through 20, the rest, we have the story of God's protection of Abram and Sarai. And this is that story, which contains a narrative where Abram and Sarai go down to Egypt to escape a famine, right? This is also foreshadowing what's going to happen in Joseph's story. But you think about it like on this level. It's not just foreshadowing in a novel, right? This is foreshadowing in real life. God is manipulating history to unfold events that are pointing toward events that are yet to come. You know, it's one thing to sit down with a hot cocoa, you know, and read a nice little novella. But, like, this is real life. And God is orchestrating things to foreshadow things that are yet to come. It's foreshadowing what's going to happen in Joseph's story, where the entire nation of Israel ends up in where? Egypt, right? As they traveled, Abram, in this story, developed a plot, right, to protect himself by putting his own wife in danger. He instructed her to tell Pharaoh that she was Abram's sister instead of his wife. Despite Abram's lack of trust that God was going to take care of him, God intervenes to keep his seed promise to Abram and protect his family line. That's the key to that story. It's not really about Abram just being an unrighteous guy. It's about God protecting the seed promise. It's about God keeping his commitment to Abram. Look in verse 17. But Yahweh struck Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. Then Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister so that I took her for myself as a wife? So now here is your wife. Take her and go." So Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that belonged to him. I'm going to bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you. We should be having all of these things kind of rattling in our minds. I'm going to make you a great nation. Chapter 13 demonstrates that God was... So, like, again, chapter 12, what's being highlighted here? Three promises: land, seed, and blessing. What's being highlighted in that story? That God is going to remain faithful to his promise of seed, right? So as we enter into chapter 13, we're going to see a plot unfold that focuses not just on the faithfulness of God to preserve the seed of Abraham, but it's going to focus on blessing and land, the very things that God had promised. So chapter 13 demonstrates that God was blessing Abram, just as he had promised. Abram became exceedingly rich in chapter 13, and he returned from Egypt to Canaan, to the land, to the place where he had made the altar. And once again, Abram called upon Yahweh, just like he did before. Abram was with his nephew Lot, and God blessed them so much. So it's almost like just being at Abram's side, all this blessing is going to spill over on you, you know. And God blessed them so much that they needed to separate because the land couldn't support the two of them. So Lot went to the Jordan Valley, where there was a very wicked place called Sodom, right? And as for Abram, the Lord spoke to him. Chapter 13, verses 14 through 18. And Yahweh said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, "Now lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward. Now, where is he? He's now in the area of Canaan, right? Look all around you. In verse 15, for all the land which you see, I will give it to you, and in your to your seed forever. And I will make your seed as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your seed can also be numbered. Arise, walk about the land through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you. Then Abram moved his tent and came and lived by the oaks of Mamre, which are in Hebron. And he built an altar to Yahweh. So let me ask you something. What do you see repeated in this text?
Offspring,
seed, descendants, right? Anything else? He built an altar. Yeah. We see this repeated pattern, right? God does what he says he's going to do, or he just even sets the promise out there. And what's the response of Abram? Builds an altar, right? He's worshiping. Yep. Going to give him many descendants. If all we do when we're studying Scripture is pay attention to the repetition, we're going to get to the point of what this is all about. What we have to be careful about, you know, is just making these into, again, I just want to say that like this, flannel graph character studies, okay? There's more than that going on in the text. In fact, the point of the text is not just to simply highlight how great Abram is or how lousy he is for putting his wife's life on the line. What's the point of this? Yeah, well done. Yeah, there's a subplot going on here. And that is related to Lot, right? But what's amazing is this. Lot's associated with who? Abram, right? And that's going to make all the difference in Lot's life. Because it's Abram and God's promise to Abram that is going to benefit Lot in the end, right? Yep. Yeah. And so think about that for a second. Who's reading this? Original audience. Israel, having been taken out of Egypt, right? Why did God take Israel out of Egypt? What did he say? You're going to go out, and what are they going to do? Before they get to the promised land, why does God take them out? He tells Pharaoh over and over, I'm going to take them into the wilderness so they might worship me. He's identifying, this is my people, right? And here in Genesis, their forefather, the one through whom they came, that's exactly what he's doing. He's worshiping God, right? He's building these altars. They're going to be expected to do the same thing. Very good. So we see in the end of chapter 12 that God begins to do exactly what he promised. He's committed to blessing the seed. He's committed to protecting the seed of Abraham, right? Abram at this point. In chapter 13, we see that blessing begins. He blesses them so much that they have to separate. The land won't contain them. And he makes this commitment again. This, everywhere you're looking right now, I'm going to give it to you. As far as you can see, this is going to be yours, this land of Canaan. So chapter 14 it's a fascinating story about how kings, this group of kings, attacked the wicked city of Sodom and took everything, including Lot, Abram's nephew. Do you remember, again, God's promise in chapter 12? I will bless those, this is what Neil pointed out, I will bless those who bless you and what? Curse those who curse you. So despite the wickedness of Sodom, God enabled Abram to pummel the kings who had grouped up together. Now, one of them, if you spend some time in Genesis 14, you'll notice that there's a lot of numbers thrown around. There's four kings against five kings, and the four kings are so strong that they defeat the five kings, but yet then Abram is almost like just one king with a couple of buddies, and you know, they've got like 300 troops, and they beat the really strong four kings. Okay, they just take them out, all right? God is enabling Abram to pummel the kings who pummeled Sodom because Abram's allies and kinsmen were in Sodom. You see that? And after a decisive win, Abram is visited by a mysterious priest, and what was his name? Melchizedek, right? Melchizedek was both a priest and a ruler. A priest before there was a priesthood. Okay? Think about that. Now, so there were, at this point in redemptive history, men acting as priests, particularly over their family. Abram was doing that, wasn't he? He was doing that by building those altars. Here we have Melchizedek, who's both a king and a priest, just like Jesus was going to be, right? In fact, the author of Hebrews makes that super clear, points to us to Melchizedek to demonstrate the superiority of Christ in Hebrews chapter 7. Does your mind just kind of like, how perfectly God has written his scriptures? How we can see even the glory of Christ reflected here. In fact, this mysterious man, Melchizedek, blessed Abram by God Most High. Are you seeing how God was keeping his promise to Abram? I'm going to bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you. Here we have this sort of mysterious priest blessing Abram. Look in chapter 14, verse 19. Then he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." What enemies? These incredibly strong kings that the nation of Sodom and their buddies couldn't conquer. Yet Abram, when we look at him, we're seeing somebody who just, it's just God's choice. I'm going to just bless you. Why? Because he has an eternal plan that he is unfolding. Then he gave him, in verse 20, the tenth of all. And the king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give the people to me, but take the possession for yourself." I love this. Sodom is like wanting to bless Abram here, right? The king of Sodom. "I have raised my hand to Yahweh, God Most High." Verse 22. Then Abram said to the king of Sodom, this is interesting, "I have raised my hand to Yahweh, God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth." By the way, that's the same thing that same description of God that was given by Melchizedek in verse 19, "that I will not take a thread or a sandal strap or anything that is yours, so that you would not say, I have made Abram rich." Why is that important? Yeah. This is absolutely a decisive work of God Most High. completely, right? Nobody else is going to get credit for this. Land, seed, blessing, nobody else. Well, in chapter 15, in Genesis 15, Yahweh visits Abram in a vision. So we've seen this promise that was given in chapter 12 unfolding, right? Like, we've seen blessing in his life, we've seen land, we've seen a protection of the seed. Well, here in chapter 15, Abram has a problem. Despite God's promise, he still had no offspring. That should make the reader wonder, you know, is God going to stay faithful to the promise of the offspring? And not only did he not have offspring, he had a wife who was barren. I just love it how throughout Scripture, God sets everything up against himself. As if everything else is building up against him. And we're all standing there wondering, like, God, how are you going to come through this time? How are you going to do it this time? And he just lets everything build up against him. In fact, he chooses the weak things of the world to shame that which is strong. He chooses the less intelligent to shame that which is, right, wise. He lets it all stack up against him. Now think about your life. Does God do that in your life? Does he tend to have a way of letting things stack up against you? So that you realize there is absolutely no other way that his promises are going to be fulfilled without him? That's what begins to unfold here in chapter 15. Despite the fact that Abram has no offspring, it should make us be wondering, like, okay, Lord, how are you going to do this? Abram became convinced in chapter 15 that Eliezer, a member of his household, would be the heir to all of his blessings. But the Lord had a very different plan. Let's read chapter 15, verse 3. And Abram said, "Since you have given no seed to me, behold, one born in my house is my heir." Then behold, the word of Yahweh came to him, saying, "This one will not be your heir, but one who will come forth from your own body shall be your heir." And he brought him outside and said, "Now look toward the heavens and number the stars, if you're able to number them." And he said to him, "So shall your seed be, or your descendants." Then he believed in Yahweh, and he counted it to him. That is, Yahweh counted it to Abram as righteousness. That's a key verse, right? That's a key verse. Abram believed God, and God reckoned it unto him as what? Righteousness. When we get to the book of Romans, Paul used this very fact to demonstrate how belief is the key to righteousness. Here we see it in Abram. Abram must trust Yahweh to fulfill his promise of offspring. Not just through his household, not through some random member of his household, but from Abram himself, who's married to who? Sarai, who happens to be what? A barren woman. Abram must trust the Lord to fulfill his promise. The rest of the chapter, God continued to reveal more to Abram about his plan, more specific. It's like he's bringing it closer and closer, more into focus. He predicted that Abram's descendants were going to become sojourners and slaves in a land, not their own, for 400 years. How would that read to the original audience on their way out of that slavery? In the exact time which God had said that it would happen. Think about that. He told him exactly 400 years. And here we are, coming through the Red Sea, 400 years later. headed off to Canaan, which God had promised as well. So it really sets things up. So by the time you get to, into Deuteronomy, for example, and we're reading about how, or Numbers, we're reading about how they get up to Kadesh Barnea, right? They've got all this information. They know how a person becomes righteous even, right? By faith. And there they stand. They send in spies who come back with all this fruit, all the things that God said that this land would look like. And yet, the Amorites are in there. And the Amalekites are in there, right? Some of the very people that God had already spoke about in the book of Genesis. The book of Genesis would have been incredibly important for them to see that, you know what? God does exactly what he says he's going to do. So maybe we should trust him. Maybe we should trust him. So at the end of the chapter, something incredibly special happens. Look in verse 17. Could someone read verses 17 to the end of the chapter for us, please? Thanks, Josh.
Chapter 15?
Yep, 15 verses 17 to the end.
It came about when the sun had set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between these pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite and the Kenizzite, the Kadamite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Hittite, and the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Girgashite and the Jebusite.
Interesting. Who are all these people? They're people that they're going to encounter in the land. By the way, what's happening here? What's happening? Where's Abram? Verse 12. He's asleep. What's God doing here? Yeah, he's making a covenant. We have all of the elements of an ancient covenant right here. Remember how we talked about that at the very beginning? If you remember several weeks ago now, you're like, Mike, we've been off for like the last month here. But several weeks ago, we talked about what an ancient Near Eastern covenant involved. All right? A greater king would conquer a lesser king, and they would make this pact, this covenant together. And that covenant would be sealed by the splitting of an animal, and the two of them would walk through it. Well, here you have Abraham flat out asleep. So what does that imply? Yeah, this is 100% dependent on God and God alone. This is what I'm going to do. Interesting, he appears as a smoking oven and a flaming torch. As we encounter Yahweh throughout the law, we're going to find many, many manifestations of him as fire. Can you think of any? What's that?
Burning bush.
Burning bush? Yep. So when Moses encounters this, what's he going to be thinking? Where else do we encounter God being manifested as fire? Yes. Think about that. This same pillar of fire that's cutting this covenant, 400 years earlier, is the same thing that Israel is watching leading them through the Red Sea. Right? All right, I'm going to pause there. Any questions, concerns, snide remarks this morning?
Yeah,
yes, snide remark?
Sort of.
Okay, great.
So Abraham believed God and was imputed didn't believe God, what would he do? Because you see him later, instead of trusting in Sarah, he goes with Hagar.
Yep.
Which seems like he's not really believing.
Yeah.
So what would, do you have any comments on that?
Well, kind of sounds like us, doesn't it? I mean, so often, I mean, like, so God's righteousness is reckoned to him at that point, right? So we would look at that, and especially based on what we read in Romans, we would say, well, we're dealing with a saved person here, somebody who's been redeemed by faith. But he certainly isn't perfect. In fact, we see him more than just with Hagar, but we see him again putting his wife on the line when he goes, well, he has like a similar experience that he had in Egypt, right? Does the same thing over again. What strikes me about these scenarios, because, by the way, the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, if you see what words are repeated there, it's about righteousness and justice. And you see God responding to the fact that Abraham has this level of righteousness now. But yet, God is, he's still imperfect. And so we see God, my takeaway from all that is that we see God utterly committed to his promises, despite the fact he's dealing with flailing, failing individuals. So yes, Abraham, before God, is reckoned as righteous because of his faith in this promise. Yet, he doesn't know all the details of it yet. He says it's going to be from his own. At that point, all he knew was it's going to be from your own body. But then when he does this whole rigmarole with Hagar, it's after that that we find out, no, it's going to be through you, Sarah. It's going to be through Sarah, not through this Hagar, right? Does that help a little bit? That's how I process it. Yeah.
And they're supposed to go to Canaan. What? Do you feel like that was the promise in the beginning? Like, do you think God maybe told Terah to go to Canaan? And then he stopped because it says that he dwelt?
Yeah. If we could say, if nothing else, we could say this is an evidence of the providential hand of God, right? That he had an eternal plan and he is ensuring that this is going to happen. And, you know, that magical phrase in chapter 11's there, these are the generations of Terah, are pointing that out. Follow this. Pay attention to what's about to happen. Now, there's also going to be times when we encounter that phrase, by the way, where it's evident that, okay, this is not going to be the line. Okay? We're going to find that in, for example, with Esau. This is not going to be the line. Okay, but when we encounter that phrase, we want to be thinking about certainly the providential hand of God to fulfill his promise of descendants or a descendant, right? Yeah, that's a good observation. Yep.
Yeah. I just, sorry, but I just,
that's okay.
It says that he was told to go.
Mm-hmm.
He was told to go to Canaan, but he stopped.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I got you. Okay, I missed that.
Something that God said, go to Canaan. Why would they? It says, and they were to go to the land of Canaan.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, there was direction there. And that's just like, I've heard this a long time, you know, before. I just never, like, looked more into it and just see why.
Well, and again, this is why we hook on to that line. Right? Because what's unfolding here is that plot. How is God going to keep this promise that he made to crush the work of the serpent? And that's what we're following. So it's going to be linked to that. Yeah. Good observation. Ed, did you have? Well, what gave him... I'm sorry, I meant not...
I mean, if Abraham would have become rich at
Oh.
There's God's promise playing out. That's just how he chose to do it. And if David would have killed Saul, he would have said, yup, there's the king.
Mm-hmm.
So what tells a man to go, no, he's not using me now at this point. He's still going to accomplish it with some other man at some other
point. I got what you're saying.
Yeah,
and I don't know that I can, other than to say we do see evidences of, especially Abraham at the time in Genesis chapter 22, God tests him, you know. Okay, now that you finally got your promised son, I want you to sacrifice him. You've been doing all these, think about that, foreshadowing too, right? You've been making all these altars along the way, and now I want you to worship me like this. And of course, God stays his hand, and we have a foreshadowing of the Father's sacrifice of the Son, Christ, right? But yeah, I mean, I think that it, those are the things that we think about in terms of our own existence. As we're studying this, this is what happened, you know. Like, there's an element here where you go, well, apparently God's providence was going to stop it right here. You know, and I certainly think that in our lives, that's important to understand too. Like, as we look back over the history of our lives and we think about what could have been, what should have been, we have to be able to trust that God's sovereign hand has been guiding us, protecting us, steering us. Are we making choices throughout this journey? Of course we are. You know, God didn't force Abram's hand to go and lay with Hagar. Abram made that choice. But God still had his sovereign plan that he was going to fulfill. So I think there's lessons there for us to be able to at least provide enough comfort in knowing that God is providentially working out things according to his eternal will.
See that there with the king of Sodom, right?
Yeah.
He was given, that's a huge opportunity.
Yeah. You got saved out of this, right? Yeah, a few chapters later, absolutely destroyed, right?
So the takeaway is what Eve did to Adam, Sarah did to Abram.
In what way? Yeah, that was her idea, wasn't it? That was her idea. But I would tell you, men, you know, you should probably listen to your wife once in a while. So. All right. Anyone else? I have a question for you then. First of all, is there anybody in here who's actually done any of the homeworks? Good job. I see a few hands. So you've got more. And I just want to help you to realize the importance of doing that. The helpful piece of it is that it's going to focus us in on doing some types of Bible study that maybe you haven't done in the past. For example, for not this coming one, but the next one will be to study the background of Exodus. So if you haven't done so yet, what I would do is just encourage you to do some of the homework. We've been giving out these sheets every week. If you need it digitally, just let me know. We'll try to send some out to you digitally. But there's instructions along with some of the previous ones that tells you how to use some of those tools that we've been handing out. And if you get it digitally, you'll be able to see that. So, and last thing is, I want you to share very quickly, rapidamente, what is one thing that you're going to walk away with today? And don't make me call on you, because I will. One thing that you'll walk away with today. Amen. Mm-hmm. He's the one that's going to be the promised seed, right? That's right. Two more. Good, good, good. All right, one more.
God is a God of second chances.
He was very patient, wasn't he? And determined, too, to keep his promise. All right, let's close in prayer.